You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Wednesday, April the 18th. And I hope that we will have Bill Bradley on the line with us shortly. We are trying to reach him. His line is busy, so he's chatting with someone else. We're going to try to get him off the phone, and we will then invite your questions for him. Bill Bradley is a former U.S. Senator and presidential candidate, and he's also the author of a new book about changing politics as usual in this country. Bill Bradley says we are at a crucial moment in our nation's history, and we need to embrace an ethic of connectedness, collective action, and individual responsibility. He says we need this to solve our nation's most pressing problems. He says both the Republican and Democratic parties have failed us, and he suggests changes that need to be made in our parties, our politics, and in our citizen activism. So we will continue to, so it looks like we're not going to be able to get a hold of our guest. Is that what I'm being told here? Because I'll move on to another topic if there's no chance. Anyway, I see our lines are lighting up. I'll give the numbers if you would like to talk to Bill Bradley in the hopes that we can reach him. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. 263-1890. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Bill Bradley is the author of the new book, The New American Story. And he says that the party that embraces this new American story is going to be ruling in generations to come. Bill Bradley is a Rhodes Scholar. He's an Olympic gold medalist. He was a professional basketball player. He was elected to the Senate from New Jersey 3 times. And as you know, he also ran for president. He is the author of several books, including the recently published The New American Story. Oh, good. We have reached him. So we will invite you to join in at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Bill Bradley, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for being with us.
It's great to talk to you.
So why do we need a new American story?
Well, because we've been in the grip of an old story, and the old story is essentially a can't-do story. As in, we can't make Social Security solvent for 75 years. We can't provide everybody with health insurance. We can't break our addiction to oil. And America is really a can-do country, and its people are can-do people. In addition, the old story is a story of fear and lack of compassion, America-only policies abroad. And as I look at it, we've been in the grip of that story, and the only way you break free from an old story is to have a new story, and that's what the new American story is.
Yeah. Aren't we embarking on that now, following last fall's election?
Well, actually, if you look at the Congress, there are about 40 seats that are competitive, and so Democrats won more than their fair share of the 40 seats. But if you're going to transform America, you have to have a much more competitive Congress, and if you're going to control the Congress, you have to think much bigger. You have to deal with major national issues. And I think the Democratic Congress has done a really good job in terms of being disciplined, in terms of keeping the campaign promises that they made. But we got to go much bigger than that, and you need actually reform of the whole system.
Yeah. You say in the book that both political parties have failed us. How have the Democrats failed us?
I don't say the Democrats have failed us. I say that Republicans can't tell the news story, and I say Democrats don't tell the news story. And the reason Democrats don't tell the news story is I mentioned 8 curses that the Democratic Party has to deal with if we're going to be able to tell the news story. Mm-hmm. And one of them is that we don't think big enough. You know, we have not done national health insurance. We've not had any bold ideas to break our addiction to oil. We have not made major efforts to dramatically increase the salaries of public school teachers and hold them accountable. And we've done nothing to solve Social Security. So I think there are a number of things that we need to do, which means thinking bigger. I then think that we're self-consciously secular. I think that we should be more open about the morality of our views. I mean, health care should be a right. The president shouldn't lie. You should be stewards of the land and the water. I think these are basic issues that have rooted in morality, and we have those issues. We shouldn't hesitate to do that. And then third, I could go down the all eight if you want me to, but then third, I think that we have to be build a structure for the party. Since John Kennedy, we've been waiting for the charismatic leader to return and inspire us all, and everything happens because of that person. The Republicans, on the other hand, have made major investment in structure beginning in 1971, and that structure envisioned a pyramid. The first level of that pyramid is money, lots of money. And that money then funds think tanks that come up with radical ideas, such as privatization of Social Security. Then think of the next level, where those radical ideas are pushed up to political gurus who find language to support those ideas. And then think of it pushed up to the next level, which is the level of the media, where Rush Limbaugh and other people repeat those phrases developed by the political gurus over and over and over. At the top of that pyramid is the presidential candidate of the Republican Party. Now, for Democrats, invert the pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
Every Democratic candidate has got to have its own money, its own think tank, its own political gurus, its own media. It's a colossal duplication of effort. And what I say is that charisma is fine. I have nothing against charisma, but without structure, it doesn't work. For example, at the end of 8 years of Bill Clinton's presidency, who was certainly a charismatic leader, and this is not a knock on him, but there were fewer Democratic senators, fewer Democratic congressmen, fewer Democratic governors, fewer Democratic state legislatures, and the party was deep in debt. Which means that the party itself was not functioning as it should. So a charismatic leader cannot do everything. You need structure.
Talk more about this ethic of connectedness that you advocate.
Well, at the core of the New American Story is something I call an ethic of connectedness. And we all have an idea of what that is when it comes to the environment. When we see that great NASA picture of the Earth from space, you know, the blue pearl out in the darkness. When you see that, it's pretty easy to understand that we are all connected with one environment. Indeed, air pollution in Los Angeles comes in part from China and so forth. But when we get to things like health, education, tax policy, you find that there's a war between two competing ethics. The ethic of caring, which is collective action associated with Democrats, and the ethic of responsibility, which is individual action associated with Republicans. And our politics amounts to a war between those two competing ethics, when in reality, neither one of them is sufficient. If we're going to solve the problems of our country today, we need both collective caring, national health insurance, for example, and individual responsibility, meaning you got to take care of your own health. To the extent you take care of your own health, you exercise, you have a good diet, you don't smoke, you don't whatever, and you're healthier, that means you cost the healthcare system less, which means there's more money available to take care of everybody's needs. So we need both individual responsibility and caring. You can carry that through almost any subject. In the book, I talk about the eight subjects: America's role in the world, the economy, oil, the environment, pensions, health, and education. And in almost each of those, if we had a combination of collective caring and individual responsibility, we'd be able to solve our problems so we could thrive in the 21st century.
I'm sure we'll talk about more of those issues as we continue talking with former U.S. Senator, former presidential candidate Bill Bradley. He is talking about his ideas to change our political system, how to solve our nation's most pressing problems, as outlined in his new book, The New American Story. We invite your questions for him at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine, 20 minutes past 8 o'clock now on this Wednesday, April the 18th. Kathleen Dunn is with you after 9 o'clock talking more about the tragedy at Virginia Tech on Monday, prompting new discussion on the gun culture in America. She'll talk with a guest about the psychology of gun ownership and the politics and our gun culture. That's coming up after 9 o'clock. We're talking with Bill Bradley, author of The New American Story. You can talk with him too, 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. And we'll go to the phones right away. Dakey in Milwaukee. Is that how you pronounce your name?
Yes, it is, Dakey. Thank you so much, Joy, for taking my call. And Mr. Bradley, in recent weeks, I've heard you speak, and I'm so glad you're getting out there. I felt so encouraged and inspired, and I primarily want to thank you for your leadership. Much needed and a wonderful voice. And I'm engaged in what you're saying. That's why I like hearing it. I'm doing a campaign that would address violence, and it's in support of a House resolution to create a U.S. Department of Peace and Nonviolence. I think it feels the same to me as what you're saying about a vision that we can grow into. And I wondered if you're familiar with that, how you feel about it, and what in general you might have to say about peace and its role in this movement that you're talking about for a new America.
Well, first of all, let me thank you for your compliment, and also let me applaud your efforts to see your vision for a particular issue become a reality. I mean, I think peace is central. It's clearly got to be one of the objectives of any national government. I mean, the Iraq War, for example, is the biggest foreign policy mistake of my lifetime. I mean, it dwarfs Vietnam. And I think that peace exists on many levels. One is at the national level, the other is at kind of the internal level. So again, individual responsibility and collective caring. Collective caring would mean that you don't involve the United States in unnecessary wars. I mean, you don't have to go to war to show you're tough, for example. And I think that war as a last resort is a very important principle for any national government to have. And then on the individual level, we each seek a level of peace in our own lives, an equanimity, a feeling that we're at one with our world. And so the idea is you can achieve peace on both levels.
Yeah. Talk a little bit, if you will, about the current debate over getting out of Iraq. The Democrats in Congress, do you think, are they doing the right thing by putting that troop withdrawal timeline in the funding bill, the one that President Bush says he'll veto?
Yeah, well, I think that you got to see it in a larger picture. I mean, no one is under any illusion that the so-called timeline is ever going to become a reality. It's a way of for Democrats to say, look, we're different. We're hearing the people, and the people are saying, let's get out of Iraq. And the administration vetoes it and says, no, we should stay in Iraq. So The Congress has made its point. I mean, I think the fundamental issue here is a political decision. And the political decision is that we should withdraw from Iraq. And the timing of it, whether it's this date or that date, I think should be left to the military. But the key is to have an orderly withdrawal, because the mistake was made conceptually when we went into this with the fantasy that we were going to be able to create a liberal democracy out of three former provinces of the Ottoman Empire that were really made into one country by Winston Churchill when he had his colonial imagination, and that have never been ruled from the center except by ruthless force. We put ourselves in the middle of a civil war that's been going on for over 1,000 years, because people didn't think it through before we made the decision. And now people argue, well, we have to stay there. Well, how long do we have to stay there? 4 years, 3 years, 10 years? The British were there 10 years before they left. But the reality is that I think that we ought to have an orderly withdrawal and let the military tell us the timetable.
Thanks to Dakey. Sally in New Richmond is with us now. Hi, Sally.
Hi there. How are you?
Good.
The question I was going to say to you, you had stated that the Democrats were more for collective caring, and I believe you stated that the Republicans were more for individual responsibility. And yet, when they do studies, study after study states that it's the Republicans that overwhelmingly give more to charities than the Democrats. And yet, you also had stated that as Americans, we are a can-do society. And so I feel that if we are a can-do society, that we should enable people to do things for themselves also, too. You know what I mean? And I think that I don't really agree with your basic philosophy, because I think that, to me, it's, you know, not to sound insulting to you, it's kind of a Big Brother mentality where the government is supposed to take care of all our problems. And yet, you know, I don't agree with that. I think that we should take care of our own problems, and not that we shouldn't. Well, the Republicans are giving to charity, but the Democrats feel the government, you know, should be giving more to the poor. You know what I mean?
Sure. Well, I appreciate your call very much. I would ask you, and I really don't want to know, but I would ask you, in terms of whether you're doing something, you're assuming your own individual responsibility, I would ask you, how much do you weigh? And don't tell me. I would ask you, what kind of car you drive. I would ask you how many hours of homework your kids do every night. If you can answer those three things with a strong affirmative, then you are fulfilling your individual responsibility. I'd also ask you, how much do you save every week? So I think that we have individual responsibilities that could help the whole, no question about that. And I then think the question is, should there be a role for government? Yes, I think there should be a role for government. It seems to me that Republicans, although, I mean, it's not just Republicans, but more Republicans, think that there should be a limited role for government. Well, what does that mean? Does that mean abolishing Social Security, Medicare, cutting back on defense? Does that mean eliminating the federal parks, eliminating the regulatory agencies such as the Federal Aviation Administration or the Federal Drug Administration? What happens is there's never real specificity that would lead to less government. And, for example, in the Bush years, the federal spending went up 33%. In the last several years, earmarks during the Republican administration, which are special interest provisions put in appropriations during the 10 years of Republican rule, went up 873%. So the question isn't whether there should be government. The question is what kind of government. And do you want people who respect government and want it to achieve great objectives, or do you want people to be the custodians of government that essentially see it as a tool by which their special friends can be rewarded? It seems to me that that's one of the legitimate questions. And for people to say, well, you know, we don't want national health insurance because we don't want the government involved in health insurance. The little-known fact is today, over half of all spending on health care is by the government. So the question would be, if you don't like that, do you want to eliminate Medicare? Do you want to eliminate pensions for our military? I mean, health care for our military? So when we get down to this, we have to get deeper than simply the ideology. Because, sure, in an ideal world, you would want everybody to live in a family where you could take care of yourself and your family could take care of you. In the real world, that isn't the case. And therefore, as citizens, as individuals, we have to ask ourselves, what do we do about that? Do we help a middle-class family send their kids to college? Or do we say, no, it's on your back, you got to do it? There will be no government help, no government loans. I mean, one of the things the New American Story says, that any kid in the top third of his class or her class ought to be able to go to college and have their expenses paid up to $12,000. So the point is, it's not a matter of of saying, we don't want government. We have government. The question is, what kind of government you want?
I'm Joy Cardine talking with former U.S. Senator Bill Bradley about his new book, The New American Story, which talks about what changes are needed in politics and citizen activism in order to solve the most important problems facing the nation. And our next caller is Dan in Milwaukee. Hi, Dan. You're on the air.
Thanks, Joy, and welcome, Senator Bradley.
Thank you.
Hi, I wanted to get your thoughts on campaign financing, and you know, it's just something that, to me, and I think a lot of people, is so disheartening with the big money, and you know, certainly, you know, we see it on both sides of the aisle, but with this administration, you know, it seems very heavily aligned with big business and big money. And the really disheartening part is that the people responsible for changing that are the ones that benefit from that. And, you know, what can we do, or what are your recommendations? Because it just seems like there's example after example where, you know, big business really benefits in an unfair way.
I think that we need three political reforms, which I can talk about the other two later in the program, that are congressional redistricting reform, and actually when we vote. But the reform that's needed, that's pertinent to your question, is we need to have public financing of congressional and senatorial elections. That would cost us about $2 billion a year. Now, we spend $2.6 trillion in the federal budget. Seems to me that that $2 billion, to make sure that the rest of the $2.6 trillion don't go to special interests, is the best investment that a taxpayer can ever make. There are a number of bills before the Congress and Senate that do this. One by the senator from Illinois, Dick Durbin, does that. I think that it is absolutely critical to break the link between lobbyists and politician. There's nothing wrong with being a lobbyist as long as all you're providing is information. But if you're providing money in addition to information, then that creates a real conflict. So I agree with you. We have to break that link. Public financing is the way to do that.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your other ideas, especially with voting. You don't think we should just be voting on that specific Tuesday every fall?
Well, let me ask you, Joy. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, or ask the listeners, why do we vote on Tuesday?
Yeah, you know, I don't know.
Right. Mm-hmm. Nobody in America knows. I didn't know until I started researching the book. I mean, we vote on Tuesdays because in 1845, we decided that we didn't want states to vote on different days. Before that, they voted on different days. Let's vote on one day. Mm-hmm. So what day will we vote on? Well, Sunday was the Sabbath. We couldn't do that. On Monday, you were in a horse and buggy era. It took a day to get to the polls, so we couldn't vote on Monday. Wednesday was a market day, so Tuesday became the day. Now, we're in a different world now. It's 250 years later. We are 139th in the world in terms of voter participation. Italy is number one with 92%, and we're a little below 50%, and that makes us 139th. And the 50% of the Americans who don't vote, when asked why they don't vote, they give a number of reasons, but the number one reason is conflict with work. Mm. And it's understandable. You know, mother and dad often have 3 to 4 jobs between them, and they got to get the kids to this practice or that practice or get them to school or whatever. And the result is that they don't have time. And so what we should do is take the day, Tuesday, Election Day, and move it to 2 days on Saturday and Sunday. There would be no conflict with work, and parents could take their kids to the polls with them and imbue them with the prime and sacred responsibility of a citizen, which is to vote with the vote and expression of what a citizen is called upon to do, to think of the whole, not a vote to help himself or herself, not a vote to help some special interest group that they're a part of, but a vote that they cast because they believe the person they vote for will make the best decisions for all of us, the whole.
Yeah. And your third reform was to rethink how we draw those lines?
To rethink, I mean, our politics is polarized today in a way that is, you know, unappealing to most people. I mean, you see two politicians yelling at each other through their television commercials, and you think to yourself, you know, in my line of work, there's a premium on being reasonable. Now, it appears that these congresspeople, when they're calling each other names and they win because they're a better name caller, that there's a premium on being unreasonable. They're just a different species than us. So even when the success, whenever the consultants succeed in manipulating you through these negative ads to election day and you vote for someone, a lot of times the vote itself you feel not absolutely certain about. You feel like you're voting for the worst, the best of two bad choices, because of the negativity of the whole thing. The polarization that exists, I think, comes in part from the way we draw congressional district lines. They're drawn by partisan state legislators. Republican legislators try to maximize Republican seats, Democrat seats. And the result is, out of 435 members of Congress, only 40 seats are competitive. And indeed, in 2006, Democrats won more than their share of those 40. Therefore, Nancy Pelosi is Speaker of the House. Mm-hmm. But 395 seats are not competitive. And some of these districts are 60-40. Now, if I'm in a 60-40 district, I don't have to listen to Republicans. I only have to listen to my vote, my party. If I'm in a 52-48 district, I got to pay attention to Republicans, what they believe. I got to figure out how I compromise, how I get their votes. In a 60-40 district, as I say, I don't need to listen to the other party. And what I do need to listen to is the extreme in my own party, because the extreme is likely where I'm going to get a primary challenge. So you feel people going to Congress, they appeal to the extremes to avoid a primary challenge. The result of appealing to the extremes is that the people's work in the middle does not get done, and people become more and more frustrated. So the way you change that is change the way you draw these lines so we have less 60-40 districts. And you do that by having commissions, citizens' commissions, draw the lines, submit it to the electorate as a whole for a vote, or to a panel of three federal judges.
Yeah, we have a proposal like that in Wisconsin. We'll talk more about that, I'm
sure.
Well,
that doesn't surprise me because, you know, the progressive tradition, there's no place that's deeper than in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the phones. Habu in Madison. Hi, you're on the air.
Thank you so much for taking my call, and good morning, Mr. Bradley.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you, and it's a glorious day to talk to you.
Thank you.
I think... I'm listening to your comments, and of course they are well thought out and consistent with what I remember presidential candidate Bill Bradley. This is my question. In response to the first question by the lady, you were talking about Iraq, and you of course spoke about it briefly. You did mention two things which caught my ear. One was these people have been fighting there for thousands of years.
I said the Sunni-Shia dispute.
Right. And the second one was about the three areas of the Ottoman Empire.
What would you like to ask our guest?
Yes. My question is, I don't think it helps to characterize this area, which was our undoing, in such Manichaean terms. After all, we have an obligation to that area, and yes, there have been these schisms. But what is our obligation to that area? And of course, going forward, this foreign policy is going to become very important, and that always seems to be a blind spot in American policy overall, foreign policy. Never mind that we have great technology, commerce, literature. Yeah. So I ask you to be a little bit more descriptive about our obligation, and thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much for your call. You know, if you're talking about our policy toward the region, I think that we have a number of things that we have to do. First, if we're talking about Islamic terrorists, the idea of eliminating them, I support. I think that's what has to happen. But the terrorists swim in a sea of non-terrorist Muslims. And we have to do whatever we can to try to help those individual Muslims have a better chance for a better life here, so that they don't have to become suicide bombers to go to paradise. I think that that means also understanding the pluralism of Islam. Most people think of Islam as some kind of monolithic religion. It's not. There are many different kinds of Islam being practiced, Sunni Shia just being two. Then I think third, we have to make progress on the Israeli-Palestinian issue, because that lies at the core of a lot of our problems in the Muslim world. With Iraq specifically, as I said, we made a mistake. So you ask, well, what's our obligation to the area? Our obligation to the area is to not make the mistakes that we made when we decided to go into Iraq. The United States cannot guarantee every country in the world democracy. We don't have the military. We don't have the resources to do that. I think we made a mistake when we went into Iraq. If you look at every rationale for our entry, it has proven to be false. There were no weapons of mass destruction. Saddam was simply bluffing, and who he was bluffing was Iran, a country that he fought a war with for 8 years. He wanted to make them think that he had nuclear weapons. Second, we went in because Iraq was going to become a terrorist haven. It is, after we've gone in, become a magnet for terrorism. In fact, Al-Qaeda has declared an area of Iraq Al-Qaeda country. Third, we were going to go in order to obtain basing rights so we could project our power into Central Asia. No elected Iraqi government would ever give us that right. We were going to go in because we figured a liberal democracy would be pro-Israel. The fact is that 99% of the Palestinians, 99% of the Iraqis are pro-Palestinian. And finally, we were going to go in so that they would agree to produce more oil when the markets got tight, thereby moderating price. When the result has been the biggest oil supply disruption since World War II. And so every rationale that we had in going in has proven to be false. Once we've made this kind of mistake, we can either exacerbate it and continue it. And, you know, is it our obligation to stay there indefinitely? I don't think so. I think if we made progress on the other areas that I said at the beginning of this answer, the orderly withdrawal of Iraq would not be a serious blow to American prestige in the world.
Former U.S. Senator Bill Bradley is our guest. We are talking with him about his ideas to change our political system, how to solve our nation's most pressing problems, all outlined in his new book, The New American Story. We invite your questions for him at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you'll stay tuned. Kathleen Dunn is with you after 9 o'clock. She'll be talking with the author of Gun Show Nation, Gun Culture in American Democracy, talking about the renewed gun debate going on in this country following the massacre at Virginia Tech on Monday. We're talking with Bill Bradley this hour, former senator from New Jersey, author of The New American Story. And our next caller, Jim in Milwaukee, has been waiting. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to see if we can get the senator to elaborate further on some of the logical inconsistencies and conning behavior of the Republicans. In Tuesday's Milwaukee Journal, a retired Army Brigadier General John Johns and Lieutenant General Robert Gard appeared with Harry Reid in a press conference, and they talked about our use of combat troops there as alienating the rest of the world. And one other quote was that you can listen to the simplistic statements of the administration appealing to emotion and fear, or you could take an analytical approach and see the reality of the world. Now, Cheney recently has told the American people talked about the possibility of a nuclear threat of a device being set off in an American city, and he representing the Republicans who have left the borders open for 5 years, and then out of the other side of his mouth he said that, but at this, you know, we're safe at this point in time. We've kept Al Qaeda in check, in essence, in all the other areas of the world where they are. But if we lose Iraq, that they'll, by some miraculous means, they'll leapfrog into the United States and be able to do destruction to us. I think this is conning and manipulative behavior, and I wondered what your opinion was, sir.
I don't disagree. As I said, we've been in the grip of an old story, and one of the cores of the old story is fear. Mm-hmm. And I do believe that the Bush administration, in its first 4 years, used fear as a way of getting reelected. I think that their basic election message that Karl Rove decided on right after 9/11 was that Bush was going to run as commander-in-chief. And one of the key elements was he had to be protecting you from something that was real, and therefore the greater the fear, the more likely you would be to go with the commander-in-chief. And I think that's precisely what happened. I think that now what you see is a continuation of this. I mean, let's be honest. There is a real terrorist threat. This is not some kind of manufactured issue. There are people in the world who want to do harm to the United States. Well, the way you fight those countries is with intelligence, with targeted military operations, with the assistance of other countries. You don't have to invade a country in order to fight terrorism. You have the Afghan invasion was right because we went after the people specifically who perpetrated 9/11. But I think that the Cheney comment, unless we fight them there, they're going to be here, I think is the ultimate pessimistic comment. And it is a rationale given after every other rationale for moving into Iraq failed. And this was not given when we went into Iraq. This is one of these things that has been manufactured. And, of course, it is consistent with the rest of the policy because it plays on our fear. In other words, if, God forbid, we leave Iraq, and, God forbid, there is some kind of terrorist incident in our cities, you know what the Cheneys of the world are going to be saying. I told you so. Well, you know, at the same time, we continue to lose troops. We continue to spend hundreds of billions of dollars being bogged down in Iraq with no outcome in sight. And I think that living in a world where there is uncertainty, which means the possibility of a terrorist event, takes place today, as well as there's no evidence to show that our position in Iraq is the reason we haven't had a terrorist event in our cities. And I think that people have to understand that they're going to have to live with this kind of fear for an indefinite period of time. And we can be aggressive going after the terrorists, and we should, but a part of that doesn't have to be being in Iraq.
Thanks, Jim. Now Jack in Oak Creek. Good morning.
Hello, Senator Bradley. It's great to hear you on Wisconsin Public Radio. I salute you.
Thank you.
How does your connectiveness idea, Senator, help us end this historically disastrous war in the next 2 or 3 years, if that's realistic, as identified by you and some Republicans and Democrats in recent times? Is it not honestly true that as long as the war goes on, there will be no improvement in health care or education, or any of our other infrastructural problems?
I think you do make an interesting point, because the issue is raised often by proponents of the policy that we can't do these other things because we don't have enough money. We're spending about $500 billion on Iraq. And you know, when Katrina happens, suddenly we find billions of dollars to help the victims, which is, I applaud that. But let me ask you, is there any significant difference between somebody that's lost everything they had through a hurricane and somebody who's lost everything they had because they went bankrupt because they don't have any health insurance. I think Americans have to see that people are connected. And indeed, if you had fewer resources being spent on the military or on Iraq, you'd have more resources available. But Iraq should not be an excuse for not doing these other things. In the New American Story, I lay all these things out and talk specifically about how we pay for all of them. We can do all this. Iraq itself is a disaster, as I've said, but we don't have to wait till we get out of Iraq in order to make sure our public schools in America are functional. I mean, you know, in New York City in 1970, if you were a beginning teacher in the New York City school system and you had a brother or sister who was a beginning lawyer in a law firm, your brother or sister in the law firm made $2,000 more than you did. Today, that number is $103,000. So where do kids go? They go to the law school. They don't go to teach. And the result is that our children are not being taught by competent professionals over the long term. We have a large number of people who are teaching science in the United States and math in the United States schools that are not in, that wasn't their subject in college. If you take the Chinese, every high school student in China has to take advanced biology and calculus. In this country, 13% of our high school students take calculus and advanced biology. If we don't get serious about our education system, we can't wait till the war in Iraq is over in order to get serious. We ought to get serious now. Teachers ought to be paid more, and we need national standards. How do you compare the public schools of Wisconsin with the public schools of California or Georgia? You can't do that now. So we can't be assured how well kids are doing if we're a national government trying to figure out, do we have an educated population ready to work in the 21st century? So you don't have to end the war in Iraq to do the things that America needs to do.
Bill Bradley, is there anyone running for president that is telling the New American Story the way you would like to see it told?
Well, it's interesting. I don't think anybody has taken the New American Story and made it their own. I think if I look at who could do that, I think Barack Obama could do that because he needs beef. I think that John Edwards has a chance of doing an element of that. And if Mike Bloomberg ever ran, he might have a chance of doing that because he's a kind of independent voice. I think that what I would like to see, and the reason I wrote the book, was try to get consensus among the people as a whole that these are things that a national government should do. If people have consensus that a national government should assure that everybody in America has health insurance, that Social Security should be solvent for 75 years, that our public school system should be infinitely better, that we should break our addiction to oil, that retirees should not only have Social Security, but Social Security Plus, a closer, comfortable retirement. If that is what people can agree is what government should do, then I don't care if somebody else has a different idea to achieve it, but at least let's agree on the premises of what government should do at this time in our history. Mm-hmm. And that's what the agenda of the New American Story is. Who knows? Maybe a presidential candidate will take it. If a presidential candidate does not take it, then I think it's up for the people to hold our elected representatives accountable. And ultimately, power does rest with us. I mean, we are not some kind of helpless mass like the political equivalent of American Idol, voting on election day for whichever TV ad we like the best. We are Americans. We're a can-do society. And as I said about Barack Obama, you know, he gets 18,000 people at a speech. I think that's incredibly important. He's touched a streak of idealism that I tried to touch when I ran for president. But what would be more impressive is if there were 5,000 meetups, groups meeting together, 200 people at a meetup trying to figure out how they help Barack Obama get elected, right? I mean, I think or the same could be true of Hillary Clinton, or the same could be true of John Edwards. But the people themselves have to assert their power. And when we do, we're going to find we can achieve the new American story.
A couple more calls, I hope, for you. Derek in Round Lake. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you very much, Mr. Bradley, and thank you for the show, Ms. Cardine. Unfortunately, I feel that looking at the current political developments in the country, I'm sorry that the level of the social decay has gone too far, and those two parties, either Democratic or Republican, are unable to reform themselves to bring any kind of resolution to issues which are plaguing the country. On one hand, you have a atomization of the society, which basically reduces the population to be abstinent and totally incompetent in order to make any kind of political choices of any consequence. On the other hand, you have a political classes which are making decisions based by the wealth, for the wealth, using the largely abstinent and ignorant society to basically make decisions good for themselves.
Yeah, we're almost out of time, Derek. I'm sorry. The two-party system, as we know, it's unsolvable, Bill Bradley, I think, is his main point.
No. I mean, I don't think it is. I mean, after all, we're Americans. I mean, you know, if we simply made the three reforms that I'm suggesting in the new American story, we would reinvigorate democracy. Our two parties would be reinvigorated. And if indeed, for whatever reason, the two parties did not address what the American people have built a consensus about, which is the new American story, then there might end up being a third party. I don't know.
Yeah.
But the point is that we agree on so much more than we disagree with. I mean, for example, I think the biggest lie perpetrated on the American public in the last 30 years has been the red-blue divide. I don't think it's true. Right. I don't think you go to your kid's Little League baseball game and look at the person next to you and say, I wonder if they're red or blue.
Yeah.
Americans agree on a lot more than we disagree on. I think every American wants to have a good job and a good pay, health care for their family, good education for their kids, and pensions on retirement. The problem is the political process does not address those issues, so we get caught on social fringe issues.
Let me get in Bill in Madison. I hope, Bill, we have time for you. Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you very much. I remember you playing for the Knicks, and what I saw there was a tremendous amount of teamwork. Your attitudes about connection seem to be related to that, and I just want to say thank you for that consistency. Evidently throughout your life. Thank you very much.
Well, you're very nice to say that. And in fact, in the last chapter, when I write the chapter on the ethic of connectedness, I do have a paragraph after I've made the case that says, this is exactly what a successful basketball team has to do, to sacrifice for his teammates. And that's what we're all doing in an ethic of connectedness, recognizing that we can all be better if we work together than any one of us can be if we're individual out there and trying to cope with the forces of the world.
Good place to end it. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Joy.
Yes, thanks very much. Bill Bradley, the author of The New American Story. Thanks to Carmen Jackson and Leo Duran for producing the hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.